Hello and welcome to New Books in Technology. I am your host, Jasmine McNeely. Today we're going to focus on online games and virtual worlds. Specifically, we'll examine and probably dispel some of the myths about massively multiplayer online role-playing games and the people who play them. To help us with our discussion, we have Nick Yi, a senior research scientist who studies gamer behavior at Ubisoft and the author of the new book, The Proteus Paradox, How Online Games and Virtual Worlds Change Us and How They Don't. Nick, welcome.
Thanks so much for inviting me on, Jasmine. It's a pleasure.
Can you give the audience some of your background? How did you get into this field?
Sure. I've always been a gamer. You know, I grew up in Hong Kong. I still have these recollections of playing, you know, the first version of SimCity, the first version of Civilization on a PC. And when I was a undergrad in college, these two seniors a year ahead of me were doing their senior theses on the personality differences of gamers in different game genres. And they were somewhat pushing back against this notion that all gamers are a monolithic group, which we kind of still hold on to sometimes when the media reports on gamers.
Sure.
And so they looked at a first-person shooter, Quake, a real-time strategy game, StarCraft, and they looked at a MMO, EverQuest, which just come out a year. So this was in 1998, 1999. Mm-hmm. And at that point, none of us had actually played an MMO. And so they got the psych department to go out and buy them a copy. And I was a lab tech that year. So I installed the game for them. And we all tried the game, but I was the only one who liked it. And so I played EverQuest for one semester. And then the next semester, I went to our common thesis advisor. So I was still a junior that year. I said, Doug, I think there's something really, really interesting going on in these games, and no one's really studying them seriously. And Doug was actually teaching us how to hand code HTML and how to run web surveys. Again, this was back in 1999, mm-hmm. Alongside teaching us the Big Five in personalized psychology. And so he said, you know, sure, let's run web surveys of these online gamers. It makes a lot of sense since these people were already online. And so that's how it started. You know, I started running surveys on the demographics and motivations of EverQuest players, and so I've been studying gamers for almost 15 years now, and it's been a blast. So I started doing online surveys. I went to grad school at Stanford, started doing lab experiments on putting people in virtual reality, asking, you know, when you give someone a taller avatar or a short avatar, how do their behaviors in a virtual world change? And from that, I got into using techniques to look at real game data from the server side. So, you know, what does it mean to look at thousands of variables over millions of players in a game like World of Warcraft, and what kind of data and what kind of findings could you extract from that front? So it's really been a journey from the surveys to the experiments to the large-scale data analysis over the past decade.
Wow. Now, you also ran a blog, I believe, or a website called The Deadless Project?
Yeah, exactly. So the Dallas Project was where I it was my hub for the online survey. So it was essentially like the community engagement tool for both presenting the findings from the surveys as well as attracting new players to participate. And so was this, like for me, it was really an experiment because, you know, as social scientists, we're trained to really share findings academically in journals, but less so of how do you actually do it with your participants and with the community that you're interested in. Mm-hmm. So that was for me a real experiment, and I think it really shaped how I thought about doing research, that I always thought about, you know, what topics are interesting to both academics as well as the community that you're studying. And, you know, even when I was writing the book, that was really very much a part of it, was how do I write a book that's interesting to a lay audience, to gamers, as well as to academics.
Sure. Now, when you're writing The Proteus Effect, what was the impetus for this book? What made you want to write a book about it?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think I'm one of those people who I always wanted to write a book. It was something that I was always interested in doing. And when I finished my my graduate program, this was back in 2007, I started, you know, exploring, you know, if I wanted to write a book, what would it look like? So I chatted with book agents, and we had several initial ideas, but, you know, I started a new job and I just kind of got overwhelmed with everything. And so I kind of put that aside for a while. And it just felt like the right time again in 2012 when I got contacted by Yale, who eventually published my book. And it was really a point in time where I felt I'd done, you know, such a wide variety of work in the field, and I wanted to put it in a package that made sense to a general audience. I think I'd always been joking with my parents that they really had no idea what I was doing. You know, they could say, you know, he was studying the psychology of online games and virtual worlds, but I think it was really difficult for them to grok what that meant. And I'd written, you know, so many academic papers over the years, but I really saw writing a book targeted at a general audience as a real challenge. And it really turned out to be that way, that we're so, as you know, PhDs in academics, we're so trained to do academic speak, and it's so easy to write academic papers and to write in that style that it's often difficult to do the exact opposite. Is how do you write for a general audience who has no idea, you know, about your field's topics and paradigms and traditions. And so it was the right time, you know, to really synthesize the research and to write that book. And it came about at a good time for me.
So what is the Proteus paradox?
It's so the book, the central argument is that we often have a lot of these assumptions of what online games and virtual worlds are, that they're escapist fantasies, they're places where people go to relax, they're about fantasy, freedom, and fun. And the book is really about deconstructing those myths, that more often than not, it's the exact opposite, that people describe being in online game, their gameplay as a second job. Superstitions pervade these worlds. Your gender, your biological sex in the offline world, and your ethnicity and your skin color in the offline world matter in these virtual worlds in these completely unexpected ways. And alongside those, there are these powerful and unique psychological levers to change and control how people behave and think. And so the book's really about pushing back against those assumptions and saying, no, like, take another look at what's really going on in these virtual worlds.
Great. Now, you're talking about how things like race and gender and age matter. So I guess explaining for a regular audience, why do these things matter, or how do they matter with respect to these online games and virtual worlds?
Yeah, let me start with one example about with gender. And so we asked players in World of Warcraft, you know, what their stereotypes of preferred activities by men and women in these worlds were. And so the highest, most strongly stereotyped belief for female gamers is healing. So both men and women believe that women prefer to heal in these games. And we started with a survey, and then we actually dived in the game. So World of Warcraft provides publicly accessible in-game metrics for all active characters in the game. So there are millions of players. You can just type in a query, you know, their character name, and you get thousands of updated variables for that character, down to the level of how many virtual hugs they've ever given in World of Warcraft. And so we got this, you know, stereotype survey, and we went in the game. We paired the survey data to get the gender of players with their actual in-game metrics. So thousands of players participated in the main survey in this study, and we found that the stereotype was false. So men and women heal just as much or just as little, the same amount, when they're playing World of Warcraft. Where there was a difference was in the avatar gender, so the character gender. Mm-hmm. So what we found was that female avatars healed a lot more than male avatars. And the effect was entirely driven by gender bending when players play a character of the opposite gender. So when men gender bend and they play a female character, they heal more. And when women gender bend and they play a male character, they heal less. So there's this gender stereotype partly tied to how we think about normative male and female roles in the real world that, you know, women are supposed to be more supportive and nurturing. It is reflected in the game world in the form of a stereotype for healing. It turns out to be false, but it's being made true via play because of the assumptions and the stereotypes of how women and women behave. So when people play World of Warcraft, they experience a world where female avatars do heal more than male avatars. And so there's this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that makes it true. And so, you know, we think of a virtual world as presumably a place where we can explore and be free of real world norms. But in fact, they're a place where real world norms are perpetuated in powerful ways. And, you know, that's one example of how gender played a role in the game.
Now, we're using terms like online games, virtual world, MMOs, but perhaps we could, you know, maybe define those for the audience and for our listeners. So what are MMOs or MMORGs?
Yeah. Oh, it's a mouthful. So MMORPG was the original term. It's why I have stopped using it. It's massively multiplayer online role-playing games. Right. So they're virtual worlds with either a fantasy, like a medieval fantasy, a futuristic space fantasy. They're worlds with specific thematic settings where thousands or millions of people around the world can log on. The world is persistent whether people are logged on or not. So the world keeps happening and other players are in the world whether you're on, in the world or not. You log on your computer, and you customize and create your own avatar, your character in the game, and you interact with other players via, you know, chat or voice chat over the microphone. And the basic gameplay goes on a typical cycle where you kill, you know, monsters, they drop weapons and gold, and so you take what's called loot, to buy better weapons and better armor to kill bigger creatures. Mm-hmm. And as this goes on, it becomes more and more difficult to do things on your own. And so you group up with the other players first in 2-player teams and then in 5-player teams in World of Warcraft up to, you know, 25-player teams. And that's where the real social science questions come into play is what happens when you have people, you know, as young as 11, as old as 70, working in 25-player groups over 4 hours at a stretch. You know, what are the interpersonal dynamics, the player motivations, the personality issues that come into play in these virtual worlds, and what does it mean, you know, to have this virtual identity, to have these social groups in these virtual worlds where players on average spend, you know, 20 hours a week. And really the underlying question in the book is it's not about the game per se, but, you know, what does it mean to be human in a digital world? And the game is really just the context in which I'm studying that fascinating and much larger question.
Sure. Now, we're talking about virtual worlds in these games and how they're hugely popular, particularly World of Warcraft. You have things like EverQuest and Final Fantasy and various others, but that means they're attracting a lot of players. But what makes virtual worlds in these games and the technology attractive?
So early on in my research, I really focused on that question of player motivation. And there are three prongs, you know, there are three sets of core motivations in these online games. There's the achievement prong, which is all about power in different forms, whether it's power over monsters, leveling up quickly, power over other players in the form of competition and dominating other players in combat and duels, or power as a form of knowledge, you know, so just getting better at the game and understanding the rules underlying the game. The second prong is a social prong, so different ways of relating to other players, whether that's making friends, you know, conversing with them, chatting with them in the game, being in collaborative teams, and so forth. And the last prong is the immersion prong of really different ways of being part of the story of the world, whether that's, you know, the discovery and exploration of the, of different zones, finding secrets in the world, role playing, so, you know, creating a persona for your character, and just the sheer joy of being immersed in the world. And in each of those three prongs, you know, there are different levels of which you can look at it. So, you know, let's like look at the achievement prong. You know, there are a certain number of mechanics in the game that, you know, reward players for achievement and for leveling up. So it's the points, the shinier armor, the treadmill, so to speak, of the game progression. You know, but when I talk to players, you know, and ask them, you know, tell me about why you play the game, you know, some players, they'll say, you know, it's because, you know, in the real world, I feel I'm not making, you know, progress. I feel like I'm stuck in my job. It's a great job. I've had, you know, a, you know, mid-30s lawyer who said that she plays World of Warcraft for 2 hours a day because it lets her experience a sense of progress that she desires as a personality trait, but that she's not getting enough of in her offline job, which is fascinating because she was a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it really depends on the player. So for some players, it's that sense of progression. For other players, it's the sense of community that there's a, they can meet people from halfway around the world and interact with them. For other players, it's keeping in touch with their family and friends that rather than just talk on the phone, they can actually, you know, work for an hour together on this really challenging task in the game or a quest in the game. For other players, it's the immersion of being, instead of reading a book, about Legolas or Gimli in Middle Earth, what does it mean? What if they could be, you know, a character in a living, breathing world? So there are a wide variety of motivations that pull people into these games. But once they're there, they're forced to work with each other. And again, that's where the magic starts from a research standpoint. Is how do these different motivations play out in a group? And that's where all these tensions arise when players want different things. And so, you know, how do player groups and player organizations called guilds, you know, resolve these conflicts when players are in these games? And so it's that range of behavior from the individual to the group, to the community level that gets really interesting.
Now, we're talking about the players on this. And when we think about the idea of the gamer or the game player in popular culture, there is a certain stereotype related to the gamer, like what we see in TV or on movies, etc. I remember an episode of Numbers had an episode all about gaming and online worlds. But how does that image of gamers and gaming and popular culture stand up to what you found in your studies?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, so when video games first appeared in popular culture in the 70s in the form of arcade games, they were stereotyped as a adult activity because these arcade games were in bars and clubs, mm-hmm. where only adults would be. And so when video games first came out, they were stereotyped as exact opposite of what they're stereotyped as now, as being a pastime for kids with nothing better to do. But, you know, in the 80s, there was this very dramatic shift, and Dimitri Williams, who's a professor of communication, has really looked at that paradigm shift where the media started talking more and more of these games as a teenage pastime, and more specifically a male teenager pastime, that they were linking up the violence in games with a, you know, what in one Newsweek article the author said was a, you know, kind of like a deeply primal biological drive for boys to hunt. You know, so the media really consistently wove the connection between, you know, games and teenagers. And that's really what we're deeply entrenched in now. But when, you know, I've looked at these games and other researchers have looked at the demographics behind these gamers. And so when you look at video games as a whole, you know, the average age is right around 30. The gender distribution is about, you know, 60-40. In these online games like EverQuest and World of Warcraft in particular, the average age of players you know, again, right around 30, there's a huge gender skew, about 80% men, 20% women. About 50 of them, because of the age range, they work full time. The other half are mostly students, or they do half-half. A third of these players are married. You know, about one out of five of them have children of their own. And so it's a really diverse group, and it's probably 30 is probably older than you would have, you know, pegged these players to be. And, you know, the really interesting statistic that I mentioned earlier is that, you know, given that most half of these gamers have real-life jobs or working 40 hours a week, what's surprising is that the average time that these gamers play is 20 hours a week, and it doesn't change by age. There's no correlation with age. And so younger and older players play right around, you know, 20 hours. And at first, that's really shocking to non-gamers. I mean, that's half a job, you know, each week. You know, but the average, you know, American watches around, you know, 28 hours of TV a week. And so what these gamers are doing is essentially they're displacing, you know, one media, you know, for another. They're still watching, you know, a bit of TV, but they're trading a lot of that with their game hours. And so, you know, in that light, you know, 20 hours doesn't seem that dramatic when you compare it with the TV hours. You know, but as a whole, you know, these gamers are not, you know, jobless teenagers. You know, most of them are, you know, college students or, you know, early professionals with families of their own.
Right. Now, we were talking about the image of the gamer, but we also have in popular culture the image of the effects of gaming or the online gaming addiction that perhaps is inherent anytime someone portrays gaming and gamers.
Yeah.
In popular culture. Have you found that kind of addiction or negative effects of gaming in the studies that you've done?
Yeah, and it's a very, you know, complicated topic, you know, and the American Psychological Association is, you know, is talking and debating about whether there should be an actual category for this in the diagnostic manual for psychologists. And it's complicated because how loaded, you know, the word addiction is, you know, that it started off as a term we use for physical substance abuse. And, you know, in colloquial terms, you'll have people who say, you know, I was addicted to watching Lost. And, you know, addiction has this really fuzzy meaning in popular culture. Mm-hmm. So I think here's what we know and what's clear. What's clear is that some people do play these online games to their own detriment. And by that, I mean that it starts having a negative impact on their relationships, on their work life, on their schoolwork and so forth. So that much, it's not in question at all, that there are players who play and it has a negative impact, on their lives. And I think when you put it in those terms, that some people play too much and it has a negative impact, and, you know, we should help those people to try to manage and balance their lives, I don't think anyone would argue. I think gamers recognize that themselves. You know, in the literature, what we found is when we look at players who have these problems with gaming, they almost always have a parallel problem that they're dealing with. And it's almost always, you know, anxiety, depression, or self-esteem issue. And when psychologists and therapists have looked into this, in many of the papers, what tends to happen is that it's not only they happen at the same time, but it's that underlying problem that tends to be driving the attachment to the game. And that a lot of these players, what they're doing is it's kind of like a failed attempt at self-treatment. Mm-hmm. That they're feeling depressed or they're feeling anxiety, and they start using the game as a crutch. And it actually works for some people. So some people with, you know, mild depression issues or with social anxiety issues are able to kind of work themselves through those anxieties in this context, in the gaming context, where they start meeting people in the game and they kind of build up confidence that way. But for other players, it's a failed attempt that, you know, they have a depression problem in real life. They're going through some kind of marital crisis or they're unemployed. They start playing the game and they get attached to the temporary fleeting sense of satisfaction in their game persona, and it becomes a vicious cycle, and that's where it becomes a problem. And, you know, all these studies tend to indicate that the biggest red flags for these gaming problems are the pre-existing psychological vulnerabilities in depression and social anxiety. But, you know, one phrase that Dimitri Williams used that I like a lot is that it's really the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Mm-hmm. So people who have a normal palette of social outlets, that they have, you know, friends they hang out with in real world, they have friends they hang out with online, that online portion can be a beneficial part of their social interaction. They're using the online part to keep in touch with people that they know in the real world that they're geographically separated from. So it becomes this healthy part. You know, there are romantic partners or families who play together, and so parents can really watch how their children behave when they attempt to be a leader in a group of adults. And so it becomes a valuable window for them. And so it can be a beneficial part of the palette. It becomes a detriment when it's the sole social outlet, for example, that it's the only place where people are socializing. Then it becomes really, really dangerous. And I think where the term, you know, online gaming addiction becomes a tricky term is where it gets people focusing on the technology rather than the psychology of the players. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of therapists are realizing is it's a misnomer, because in most of these cases, when you take the game away, the problem is still there. And that, you know, simply taking someone away from the game doesn't really solve the problem. And so what a lot of therapists will talk about is really, you know, either using the game or really trying to understand the underlying problems through the lens, you know, of the game, and to really help the person understand the full set of problems that they're going through and why the game is becoming a failed outlet for them. And so the problem is definitely there, but I think oftentimes when people talk about online gaming addiction, it becomes framed as a purely technological problem. Mm-hmm. And I think it becomes dangerous because it gets people thinking that taking the game away is the solution when it oftentimes is not.
Sure. Now, when we talk about online games, and particularly the ones that allow for multiplayer and massively multiplayer usage, are those separate and distinct from, say, like a Halo or the various online sports games that allow multiple players? I'm not sure how many, but usually when we think of these, you know, MMOs, we think of those that dealing with a fantasy component. So are they inherently different, not just because of the amount of people who could play them, but because of the environments that are created?
I would argue yes, and I think there's a spectrum of games in different established genres, and I think to the degree that, you know, the game allows, you know, players to interact with other players online, that allows them to create, you know, their own avatar. I think the fantasy theme in and of itself, you know, matters a little bit less, as long as there's some kind of game working context that allows players to interact together, that encourages players to work together. Mm-hmm. And so to the degree that the game that we're looking at is different from that, then I'd say the findings may apply a little less. So for example, if a game doesn't have an avatar, a way that the player is represented, you know, virtually, for example, in games like SimCity, where you have like this top-down godlike view and you never see a representation of yourself per se, you only see the city growing, then it probably applies less, you know. But, you know, especially in recent years, we're seeing a lot of blending between established genres. So we're seeing a lot of MMO like components, you know, multiplayer play, persistent worlds, customization of avatars in games, game genres that traditionally did not have them, mm-hmm. where it was not as strong as a focus. You know, so nowadays people are very familiar with playing, you know, shooter games in a multiplayer context, because that's how the genre has grown. You know, so again, I think it depends on, you know, how many of those elements. So, you know, multiplayer play, a persistent world, a virtual avatar, and, you know, a social forms of play. That's how, you know, these findings may or may not apply.
Right. Now, in your book, you make a couple of statements that I want to ask you about, and please feel free to speak at length about those. But one of these phrases you use is about the illusory promises of online gaming. And I wanted to know if you could talk more about what these illusory promises were or are.
Yeah, let me turn back to the race example, and we kind of touched on this in the beginning, and I talked about the gender example a little. You know, so one of the, I think when you ask people about virtual worlds and this notion that you can really create your own avatar and really do your own thing, there really is this sense of assumption of tremendous freedom. So in the sandbox virtual world Second Life, people can really do anything and become anyone. You know, they can become a cat, you know, if they wanted to. They could, you know, fly in outer space, or, you know, create their own imaginary, you know, tribe in the Amazon rainforest. Mm-hmm. Oops, sorry, Jasmine, I tugged on my mic. Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can.
and you know, what happens, the most striking thing about the Second Life is that it's predominantly a bunch of people shopping in a virtual suburban America. And, you know, Philip Rosedale, who was the founder of Second Life, you know, said that, you know, it could have been either Malibu or it could have been Mars. And it's pretty much Malibu in Second Life. And so, you know, for me, what was fascinating is, you know, in a world where people can be anyone they want, why do they bother buying knockoff jeans at all? But that's the predominant kind of norm in Second Life. There are people doing very, very innovative things, but the majority of people are really doing virtual shopping. Let me turn back to the race example, because I think it's almost a little more poignant. So, you know, there's this idea that you create your new identity in a virtual world. And so things like your offline biological traits, your gender, your ethnicity should stop mattering. But in an odd way, the opposite was true. So one really high tension period in online games was around 2007, 2008, when the phenomenon of gold farming popped up. Mm-hmm. Now, because these games are so tedious sometimes to play, that you have to keep killing creatures to level up, and it takes hours and hours of, you know, months and months of playtime to level up, you know, it makes sense that some players would like to bypass that time sink. And it's possible because that these games are global, and so you can play these games anywhere in the world. And so it becomes really financially attractive to pay someone in a developing country who has a much lower standard of living and labor cost to play the game for you. And so there are these power leveling services, and there are also these services to accumulate gold to sell to you for US dollars. And it's financially viable because the labor costs and the standard of living in these other countries are much lower. And in World of Warcraft, there was this huge furor over these what are called gold farmers, because they were seen to disrupt the game for normal players. And in this period, there was the assumption that the majority of these gold farmers are based in China. And so these Chinese gold farmers are playing the game, and they're ruining the game because they are hogging these rich resource spots. They are driving up the game inflation. They're making it difficult for new players to play the game, and they therefore must be exterminated. And so there were these player-made videos on YouTube showing groups of players banding together to harass and to kind of herd these suspected Chinese gold farmers into a corner and then massacre them. Mm. And so you know, there was one series of videos called Farm the Farmer's Day that kind of set these massacres to a music video. They're really quite grim, but they were portrayed in the game community as a positive thing, because, you know, they were kind of ridding these virtual worlds of unwanted vermin. And, you know, during that period, there were so many threads on the official forums that really used, you know, Chinese as a synonym for gold farmer, that they were seen as the same package, that if someone was Chinese, they were therefore a gold farmer. And so I really was interested in this phenomenon, and I went into the game, did a lot of surveys. And, you know, one of the things I asked was, well, how on earth do you know whether someone's Chinese in an online game if all you see is this, you know, female night elf, you know, how do you know what ethnicity they are in the real world? And, you know, what some players said was, well, they had this litmus test. You know, if someone was behaving like a potential gold farmer, they would go up to them and speak to them in English. And if they could respond in English, well, then they'd leave them alone. But if they couldn't respond in English, they either ignore them or, you know, spoke in, you know, broken English, they would, you know, harass or kill this character because they must have been a Chinese gold farmer. There was this other really funny story on the forum where this French-speaking Canadian was being approached by a player who was begging for gold. And so he didn't want to deal with this player, so he responded in French. And this other player said, you know, I can't believe you. You Chinese gold farmers are ruining the game because the player didn't respond in English. And so there are these pervasive stereotypes. But what's interesting in the litmus test example is that it's not the behavior per se that was the damning component. It was the ability, the linguistic ability. And so two players doing the same thing, you know, they're interpreted very differently depending on the language that they speak and not what they're actually doing and behaving in the game. You know, I also dug a little deeper into you know, the economics and why players were frustrated with these gold farmers. And it's really complicated. What was happening was that as the games got crowded in the heyday of World of Warcraft, there was a lot of competition for resources, you know, in these games. And so it created this very, you know, tense situation where it became psychologically comfortable to blame an outgroup, you know, for this resource competition in the game. And, you know, I was looking back on other social science research to really help me understand this point. And, you know, this happened in the Gold Rush era in California when Chinese Mayan immigrants set up laundry shops and curio shops. And there was this perception by the local whites that they were draining the economy by sending their income back to China, and that they were living very frugally, and that they were ruining the economy, and that led to a period of discrimination and genocide in California in the South during the slavery era. You know, there's research that showed that when the price of cotton lowered, the number of mob lynchings of blacks increased, you know, as a way to vent economic frustrations. In the EU, during times of economic prosperity, the negative stereotypes of ethnic minorities decreases, and when the economic times are bad, the stereotypes of and prejudices against economic minorities increase. And, you know, so the argument that I make in the book is that we're seeing that same phenomenon in an online game, that when you have economic competition and, you know, a lack of resources, it becomes very comfortable psychologically to blame an outgroup. And so characters are made Chinese in a way. You know, this label of Chinese is forced on these players to support this rhetoric of gold farmers destroying the economy when in fact it's very difficult to balance game economies. That, you know, you have game developers, most of whom do not have a PhD in economics, creating a living, breathing world with thousands and millions of players, trading, you know, thousands of goods, gaining resources at different levels, and they're trying to balance this really, really complex economy. And inflation actually always happens in these online games, because when you kill a monster, it has to come back, because otherwise there'd be nothing to do in the world very quickly. And so these monsters constantly respond, and they're constantly giving you gold. And so there's this essentially open faucet of gold that's continually coming into the economy. So unless a game economy has ways of taking that money out in a really well-balanced way, you always have inflation in these game worlds. So, you know, game researchers have documented inflation even in textual online games, you know, back in the 90s. And it's just because it's because of how difficult it is to balance economies in these games, you know. But when you're framed in these virtual worlds, and the competition is really stiff in the crowded economies, and you have all sorts of inflation going on, what I argue in the book is it became really psychologically enticing to blame these economic difficulties on the minority group. And so, you know, in this virtual world of orcs and elves, you know, where seemingly elves and humans can get along and there are no national boundaries, being Chinese really mattered, you know, mm-hmm. in a really bad way, that being Chinese or being labeled Chinese could get you killed in the game. And how strange it is that, you know, this offline ethnicity should play a role in how players interact in a virtual world.
So then in virtual worlds, basically history repeats itself, and basically the games reinforce social norms.
And I think the reason they do that is because we don't really get a blank slate when we log into a virtual world. You know, one of the things I used to say, you know, there was this huge rush to do, you know, 3D conference rooms and virtual conference rooms in, you know, in Second Life and in the virtual world for a while. You know, one of the things that I always used to say was, well, it doesn't work because boring people are still boring in 3D. And you knew that, but, you know, people always had this assumption that 3D makes things more fun, but it doesn't. And virtual worlds don't rewire the norms that we've learned through our lives and how our brains work, how our brains are hardwired to work in other places. And so, you know, the ways we interact with people, you know, we did a study about personal space, you know, the personal distance between people, and whether those physical rules apply in a virtual world. And we found that they did. So there's this theory, this effect called the equilibrium theory. It's what I think of as the elevator effect, you know. So in the physical world, we use, distance and eye gaze to moderate feelings of intimacy. So when you're in an elevator and you're packed like sardines, no one maintains eye contact, because at that distance, maintaining eye contact would feel painfully intimate with strangers in an elevator. And so kind of moderate, you know, distance with eye gaze to maintain a comfortable sense of intimacy. And so we found that in Second Life, that is that we kind of took snapshots of groupings of players, in public settings. And we found that as players got closer, they were less likely to maintain eye contact with each other. And, you know, we see these effects of how, you know, real world norms or patterns repeating themselves in these virtual worlds. And it's precisely because, you know, we don't get a new brain when we step into a virtual world, that we're very much, you know, stuck with the norms and the ways of interaction that we're used to with physical bodies. You know, one of the examples I give in the book is, this classic study by Cliff Nass and Byron Reeves at Stanford University, where they looked at whether people are polite to computers, which makes no sense at first as a question. What they did was they had people take a tutoring lesson from a computer, a computer program. So they're on a desktop computer. This was in the, oh gosh, I don't remember whether this was in the early 90s or the mid 90s. And they took the tutorial, and then they would fill out an evaluation of the computer, either at the same computer or a different computer. And what they found, really surprisingly, was that people were more polite, and they gave more positive evaluations when asked to evaluate the computer on the same computer mm-hmm. than if they evaluated on a different computer. And again, this still makes no sense why people would do that. And, you know, how Cliff and Byron explain this is that we have a politeness norm in the real world, that if you go to Thanksgiving dinner and your aunt just made dinner and your aunt says, well, what do you think of the food? You're going to say, oh, it was pretty good. You know, it was wonderful. You know, but if your cousin drags you aside and say, oh, what do you think of the food? You're probably going to be a little more honest, because, you know, you're responding. You're not worried about hurting someone's feelings. Mm-hmm. And so what Cliff and Byron found was that we kind of have these, you know, modes of interaction, and we treat a computer as if it were a human, because we don't invent new modes of social interaction for you know, new forms of digital media. So we fall back on our established norms. And so we're more polite to the computer that we were trained on, because we're in fact worried about hurting the computer's feelings, even though rationally and consciously no one believes that computers have feelings, but we treat them as social actors with feelings. And so, you know, again, we have all these different angles and findings that really show how people react in virtual worlds and with digital media using norms that they've learned in the physical world.
Great. Now, so if someone were in their local bookstore or browsing Amazon, as we all do sometimes, and they encounter your book, The Proteus Paradox, if you can give them a short blurb about what your book is about and the importance of your book, what would you say?
Wow. Okay. I'd say it's a book about challenging the myths of freedom, fantasy, and fun in these virtual worlds, and using a really guided cultural tour of what players do and what it means to live in these virtual worlds. And I think it's important because our lives are becoming increasingly virtual. These players, millions of players around the world, spend 20 hours a week on average in these worlds. A lot of them fall in love there. A lot of companies are exploring, virtual modes of work and interaction. And so these worlds are really where we, work, live, and play. And I think it's important to really understand what happens there and what it really means to have a virtual identity and what it doesn't mean to have, a digital identity, because our lives are becoming, increasingly virtual. And I think that the book really, the heart of the book, the question isn't really about games, like I mentioned earlier. It's really about understanding what it means to be human in a digital world. And I think what's fascinating from a psychology, a social science research standpoint, is that understanding these worlds really helps, reflect and reveal what it means to be human. It reflects, our humanity and our own weaknesses and strengths back at us. And so that's why it's been a fascinating topic of research for me.
Now, where can they find the book? I said Amazon and the local bookstore, but where can they find the book?
I think Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, a lot of the major retailers online will have the book. The digital version is also available. I know for sure on Amazon and the Nook version. I'm not sure about the other versions, but definitely the Kindle and the Nook version are available in ebook format.
So what's next for you?
As I was writing in the 6 months, 7 months, I was writing the book. I changed into a new job at Ubisoft. That was exactly the summer that I changed. And I also moved into a new house with my partner. And so those 6 months were like too much of good life happening at the same time. And it really took me a while to decompress from everything happening. So I've shifted into this new role at Ubisoft where I'm fully in the game industry now, and it's really been a blast. So I used to be on the other side of the fence and really looking in at games as an academic researcher, and so I really wanted to see what it was like doing research directly in a game company. So we're doing a lot of stuff now with direct game data. We actually just gave a talk at the Game Developers Conference. My colleague Nick Ducheneau and I, we've worked together for a long time. We gave a talk using some of that data. And so we're in a game company now, but we're still able to do research and still able to publicize that research. So that's what I'm keeping myself busy with in the near term. And it's been really a great journey in studying online games for more than a decade. And I'm curious myself to know where this all leads.
Now, can our listeners read any of your writings online? Do you have a blog?
So I have a website, nickyee.com, N-I-C-K-Y-E-E.com. So academic papers, there's actually a free PDF of the introduction chapter to the book that's available there. It's linked on the main page. And, there's a link to the Daedalus Project. So the Daedalus Project was geared towards gamers. There's a little bit more jargon in it, but if any of the listeners are gamers or interested in a blogish format for those earlier findings, they'll find that there. So lots of writing for different audiences, you'll find that link to from my website.
Great. Well, Nick, thank you very much for coming on and talking about your new book, The Proteus Paradox: How Online Games and Virtual Worlds Change Us and How They Don't.
Thanks so much, Jasmine. This was a lot of fun, and I really appreciate the invitation.
No problem. This has been New Books in Technology. I was your host, Jasmine McNeely. Mm-hmm.